You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lisa Boudet toko ingoa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire, mo tēnei rā. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 1st of August. It's already August. Time flies. My name is Lisa Boudet. It's my last time covering as a host for Lily, and she'll be back next week. I think she actually has landed already. Next to me in studio today, I have Darish, Preet and Harry. How are you guys?
You can
speak in the microphone. That's all good. All right, so that's us. Coming up on the show today on Dear Science with AET's Alan Blackman, we talk about a lake on Mars, a 42,000-year-old worm, and finding out who wrote the Beatles songs based on statistics. Today, for our segment, with the New Zealand First Party, Harry talks to Fletcher Tabuteau, the deputy leader of New Zealand First. Darish Preet spoke with Labour MP Louisa Wall about an initiative to reduce period poverty. And she also spoke with Linda Stewart, the president of the New Zealand Educational Institute, about the upcoming primary school teachers' strike on the 15th of August. And if we have time, which I don't think we will, but you never know, I'll do a little assessment on Winston Peters' time as acting prime minister. If I can't do it live, then you can find it as a podcast on 95bfm.com and in the BCAS section, and you can find this and so many more things. So yeah, just have a listen. Remember, you can get in touch with us during the show. All you have to do is text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309-3879. All right, time for science.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right, science in studio with me, Alan Blackman. How are you, Alan?
I'm very well, Lisa. All good.
All right, that's a short and brief introduction. That's all good.
Well, what else is to say, really? I mean, it's week three of semester. And,
yeah.
You know,
is it still fresh and new and there's not much to say about it?
No, I'm getting into the laboratory. That's fun, actually.
Yes. Oh, cool.
I've got a couple of grad students, so, you know. Yeah.
Oh, that's
fun.
There,
helping them, so that's all good, getting your hands dirty.
Is it better than first year students?
Yeah,
I don't want to say it.
No.
That's all right.
First year's a performance. That's, you know, you stand in front and give a performance. So, yeah. They're all good in their own way. There we go.
All How's right. That? That's a very diplomatic response.
Yes.
Okay, so first topic of the day. It's pretty exciting. Apparently, scientists have found an underground lake on Mars.
Yeah. This is a big deal. Obviously, a very big deal. And we talked, a month or two ago about finding organic molecules on Mars, and they are one thing that you're going to need for life. Another thing that you're going to need for life, obviously, is water.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes way back to 1877, and there was an Italian astronomer by the name of Giovanni Schiaparelli, and he reckoned he saw canals on Mars.
Okay.
And you guys know?
No.
Okay. So that was the big thing on Mars. Everyone thought that there were canals on Mars after he came along. He'd looked at it through his telescope. And so there are obviously canals. So obviously there were little green men on Mars and women probably who'd made these canals. And so this is a big thing. And I think, I may be wrong, but that might have been the inspiration for War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells' story about Martians coming. And, you know, sort of based on the fact that these canals couldn't be anything else other than, made by an intelligent civilization. Unfortunately, they were an optical illusion, basically.
So.
But that got people thinking about, obviously, water on Mars and everything. And with the advent of space probes that went to look at Mars and everything, we now know that there's solid ice on the South Pole and the North Pole on Mars, which means obviously there's water on Mars. But now the interesting thing here is there's liquid water on Mars. And that's important for life, obviously. Now, the interesting thing that this is liquid water at a temperature, what they estimate, roughly about minus 68 degrees Celsius.
So is that solid form?
Well, no, it's not. It's liquid. There's the interesting thing.
So how does that happen?
Wow. So I was hoping you'd ask that, Harry. I really was. Because this is
doesn't Mars get even, like, much... Doesn't Mars get a lot colder than that at night?
Yes, this is sort of thought to be the subterranean temperature.
Oh, right.
So they've found this water at a depth of about 1.5 kilometers. So mm-hmm. they're using radar imaging and everything. And what we have on Earth, we have sort of similar things. We have what are called subglacial lakes, and they've got a temperature about minus 60 degrees, and okay. they are still water. So it may surprise you that the 16th largest lake in the world is in... Antarctica. Mars isn't in the world, Darish Fred.
Well, it's in the global world. Not our one.
So the 16th largest liquid water lake is in Antarctica.
Okay.
It's just buried 4 kilometres under the ice shelf. Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And water's got this really weird property that if you pressurise it, its melting point lowers.
Mm.
So these subglacial lakes have got tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of ice pressing down on them. And so they keep liquid via that mechanism, via this intense pressure. Now, on Mars, it's obviously not the same because these aren't subglacial lakes. This is just a lake that's under, you know, the Martian surface, which isn't a glacier. So how does this stay liquid at a temperature of minus 68? Yes. And the trick here is that it must be full of salts.
Okay.
Okay, so if you take, for example, sodium chloride and mix it up with water and you try and freeze it,
it just won't.
It freezes at a lot lower temperature than zero, okay? And so this is their idea that it's very, very rich in salt, and so that keeps it liquid even at a very, very low temperature.
How are they sure that it's liquid water?
It's from the radar signature. Okay. So they can distinguish liquid water from ice. So don't ask me how. But
and also, I mean, sorry, I'm cutting you, but it's interesting because we think that because we've got water, we've got an environment for life,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is the next thing that they're going to be looking into, I assume.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So,
and so what kind of life are we talking about?
Well, microbial life,
okay.
And to start off with anyway. And what they say is that with these subglacial lakes, they've been isolated from the rest of the world for like millions of years, especially this one in Antarctica. And supposedly there is evidence of life in those, even after they've been isolated for that long, at those extreme pressures and those very, very cold temperatures, there's still life down there, supposedly. It's not absolutely been proven. And so they're sort of surmising that the same thing could happen on Mars, that this big underground lake could hold life. They don't know that. The other thing they don't know is the depth of the lake. So, again, radar can only tell you so much. So it could be sort of tens of centimetres deep, at a minimum, to a maximum of goodness knows what. But and they also don't know whether it's just an isolated lake and that's the only one there is, or whether it's part of a system of underground lakes, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously more research is needed, which is always, you know, that's that famous scientific line. And the spacecraft that's doing this, the thing called Mars Express, and it is sort of nearing the end of its useful life. So if they want to find out stuff, they've got to hurry up.
Don't they have a second one coming?
Chances are they probably will, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, but it's a matter of whether it's got this equipment on it or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very specialised equipment. And the data that they used for this was collected between apparently 2012 and 2015. So it's only just been published. So there's a significant sort of time lag between actually picking up the data and then analysing the data and then publishing the data. So, but, you know, very, very exciting.
Yeah.
And it's been surmised that some of the outer planets as well, and some of the moons, in fact, of Saturn have got sort of large underground lakes and everything. So, you know, water may be more abundant in the universe, in the solar system than we knew before.
Yeah, maybe there's lots of little green men and women all around. That's exciting. I know.
Indeed.
I know that it's not true.
We'll see.
All right, moving on to the next topic, which you yourself labelled as, and I quote you, astonishing and just mind-blowing. So go on, blow our minds.
Well, this is, and quite frightening, really, if we're going to be brutally honest. Okay. So Siberia is pretty much covered in permafrost, basically. So a very, very cold part of the world.
Can you just quickly explain to our listeners what permafrost is?
Absolutely.
And remind myself.
So permafrost is when the ground doesn't thaw out during the year.
Okay.
So, and Siberia is a good place for that because it's, you know, pretty damn cold in the winter. And so when it does thaw out, when the ground thaws out in Siberia, it's about sort of 80 centimetres or so maximum,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then below that, it's just solid ice forever and ever, amen.
Okay.
And they estimate that only in the last 100,000 years, the permafrost has never melted below a depth of 1.5 metres. That's the absolute extreme.
Last how many years?
Over the last 100,000.
Okay.
So what they've done, they've taken these cores from the permafrost and they're analysing them, and they found these nematodes in them, these little worms, okay? And these little worms can be sort of 0.1 of a millimetre to about 2.5 millimetres long or whatever.
So they're really tiny.
Yeah, so these tiny little things. And these guys, so the bore that they got them out of, they radiocarbon dated to ages, or in two bores in fact, ages of 30,000 years and 42,000 years, okay?
Yeah.
And they found these worms, they warmed them up to 20 degrees, gave them some agar and stuff to eat, and some E. coli, and they started living. They moved around and started feeding. And they had been frozen, estimated for 42,000 years. And
that's insane.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing?
Yes. That is, I'll give you that.
It's like in Stranger Things, and that thing comes out, and then they feed it the Demogorgon thing.
Okay.
Okay. And it's alive.
Nobody watches it?
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
I think we've got the generation gap thing going here. never heard of it.
That's all right.
But
I'm thinking like the piece of amber from Jurassic Park. Extracting the DNA.
There you go. That's more your time.
It's not that old at all. I thought you were sort of talking. You know, the eyes from Jurassic.
No. Of course not. Dinosaur time. Talking about when Jurassic Park was released.
No,
in the 90s
enough,
or something. Come on.
Yes. No. None taken.
Anyway, so, those frightening worms that can live.
It's well, okay. So they do something special, and so the trouble with being frozen, and Harry's talking about Walt Disney being frozen before,
yeah,
which may or may not be an urban myth. We don't know. The trouble with that is that water in your cells. So when water freezes, it expands. Mm-hmm. And again, that's a weird thing about water. You pressurize it, and the freezing point lowers, and when it freezes, it expands. Two things that sort of normal liquids don't do.
Yeah.
So if it expands, all of your cells in your body which contain water, they rupture when the water freezes. And that's why probably Walt Disney won't be able to be brought back to life if he is indeed frozen, because all of the cells and the vital organs and everything will have ruptured. But these nematodes can apparently expel the liquid, that water, from their cells when they feel the temperature getting down to around about zero, or whatever, which is utterly bloody astonishing.
Yeah.
I don't know how the hell that works, but, you know, absolutely incredible. And prior to this, they had done studies on these nematode worms, and they'd found that they could wake them up after they'd been frozen for 39 years.
Okay, so they just got...
So, you know, like 42,000 is, you know, if you can do it for 39, you can
so
do it for 42,000.
They did go into this, like, maybe, like, a little bit hopeful, thinking, maybe this will happen.
Well,
we might as well give it a go, eh?
Yeah.
We got them, so...
This is utterly, utterly astonishing.
So why do you think it's frightening?
Well,
because it's just worms, like, obviously not, I don't know.
Yeah, but...
Ethically speaking, it's nothing. It's
still 42,000-year-old organism.
Yeah, but it's... I don't know.
What might it do to the, you know, if it gets out, you know, all this stuff? Who knows? But I just is quite...
It freaks you out.
Quite incredible. Yeah, no, it does. It absolutely freaks me out. I prefer to work with inanimate objects in the chemistry lab, not these things that, you know, can grow and
breed.
Are
you going to have nightmares of them tonight?
Probably.
Tiny little worms coming.
Brain or whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Just don't go to Siberia, you'll be fine.
Ancient diseases.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I suppose that's one interesting point that can be made.
Yes. Yeah.
That could lead to some pretty devastating things. If we wake up from the dead, well, not really dead, I suppose, the organisms that carry pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all the elements of a bad science fiction story, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
Really? Yeah. Yep.
Maybe someone should look into that. All right, final topic, because I think we've got about 2 minutes left.
Oh, jeez.
I know,
we
I know.
We only had 2 minutes for the last one. Yeah.
All right, okay, I'll give you like maybe 3 or something. So you're trying to make statistics appealing to
yes.
the rest of us.
Who would have thought you could do that?
I know. And so you're mixing statistics with the Beatles.
Yes.
And you... Come on, fascinate me with your statistics.
Not my statistics, but
someone else's,
from Harvard and some guy from Dalhousie University, which is in Canada. And they were Beatles fans, and they realised that some of the authorship of the Beatles songs was sort of up in the air. So we've got you know, the word of Paul McCartney and John Lennon as to who wrote what. And most of the songs, as I understand anyway, was sort of primarily written by one, and then the other one would come in and add a verse or a chorus or something like that, and blah, blah, blah. And so there was around about 70 songs written by those two between 1962 and 66, which whose authorship is undoubted, so we know that. However, there's one song, which is on Rubber Soul, which is called In My Life, and John Lennon swore that he wrote it when he was still alive, and Paul McCartney said, oh, no, no, he came up with the lyrics and I came up with the music. And so these guys decided to see that if through analysis of all of the songs that they know were written by one or other of them, whether they could figure out the probability that In My Life was written by either McCartney or Lennon. And so long story short, this analysis involved things like sort of chord progressions, the frequency of notes. They cut the whole song into these sort of four-note bits and saw whether the melody goes up, down, or stays the same.
Mm.
And then they applied this thing called Bayesian statistics, which I have no bloody idea what it is, but I often see it. No, not a clue, not a clue. I don't know any stats anyway. But they sort of swear that. So the long and the short of it is that the chances that In My Life was written by Paul McCartney is 0.018. Okay, which
that's
makes
funny because McCartney claims that it was.
Yeah. So, but it was a wee while ago, I guess. So, you know, who remembers what they were doing? You know, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there or something.
Do you think he would know whether he wrote that or not? I don't know. I find that a bit hard to believe.
You do, but they're both sort of claiming it. But then on the other hand, there's a song called The Word, which is an even better song on Rubber Soul, in my opinion, which Lennon reckoned he wrote, but now they reckon through this analysis, it's almost certainly McCartney's song.
Okay, I do think that maybe the analysis is wrong? Or?
Well, this is statistics. So, as the great Ernest Rutherford once said, if your experiment relies on statistics, then you need a better experiment.
Ouch. So, okay. All right. Sorry, all the statisticians out there. That was a bit.
Well, that's what he said. Hey, yeah. You know, who's going to argue with, you know, with Ernest Rutherford? Sheesh.
All right. So you're saying that it's
100.
100.
Yes. Ooh. Ekaranonata's on the 50.
Oh, my bad.
Anyway, you're saying that it's an interesting analysis that still shouldn't fully be trusted.
Well, it's keeping some statisticians in business anyway, and probably bringing statistics to the limelight, I would imagine, which all is right. not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
So very interesting. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, that was Dear Science for today. You can find that on the Beecast section. Again, listen to all our podcasts. They're really cool. And we will see you next week.
Surely will. See ya.
Yeah. See ya.
Bye.
That was Dear Science.
All right, we will play a couple of spots and a song, and then we will be right back.
Just seen them strut in. already have. They watch you sleeping, you watch their garbage cook, you'd weep a bowl of tears if you had looked. But now the gate comes down, the pangs are growing dimmer, you hold
a once-in-a-lifetime performance. The Phoenix Foundation and the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra live at the Auckland Town Hall this Friday.
Floating in the harbour, watch the night.
One of New Zealand's most iconic bands are celebrating their 20th year in style with the Bloomin' Orchestra. Fan favourites, deep cuts and their acclaimed soundtrack work. Do not miss out. The NZSO and the Phoenix Foundation celebrate this Friday at the Auckland Town Hall. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Yeah, kia ora, it's Tony here from Tika Whitty. Well, I've been listening to your sheep show every week with the girls, week in, week out, and I hold out for some actual sheep content. You know, it's all music, and I've had a gutful. How about a little less the clean and a little more how to clean your Toyota Hilux after a massive dagging session? Does the B stand for bullshit? Either pull your bloody head in or change the name of the show, OK? Thank you.
Ovinophiles are welcome to listen, but Freak the Sheep is really about that good, good New Zealand music. Zach Arnold hand-delivers interviews, live performances, tempered classics and wretched demos from Godzone. Sheep with Zach Arnold every Wednesday night 9 till 11 on 95 BFM. Thanks to Flying Out, flyingout.co.nz. You're listening to 95 BFM Radio. This is The Wire. Just before these couple of announcements, you were listening to Gun Has No Trigger by Dirty Projectors. And now it's time for our weekly segment with the New Zealand First Party.
Now it's time for Jenny Marcroft from the New Zealand First Party.
Again, Jenny is unfortunately unavailable to us today, so I was joined this morning on the phone by New Zealand First Deputy Leader and Foreign Affairs and Regional Development Parliamentary Under Secretary, Fletcher Tabuteau. So, what does a Parliamentary Under Secretary do? How does he want to be the next leader of New Zealand? How has Peters fared as leader of our country for the last 6 weeks? Here's my introductory chat with Tabuteau to find out.
So your role as Parliamentary Under-Secretary, what does that entail?
It's kind of like a kind of halfway to being a minister. It's an official title that you get so that you can do the jobs of a minister, but you're actually working for a senior minister. So I've got three Under-Secretary titles. One is for nuclear disarmament, one is for regional economic development, and one is for foreign affairs. And so in all of those, I'm pretty much the kind of a 2IC to the minister in those areas.
Okay. And you're also a deputy party leader, right?
Yeah, so at the beginning of the parliamentary term, just after we get back, the party sits down and has a vote on the leader and the deputy and the whip. And I put my name forward for the deputy leader role and, yeah, was successful in that. So I've been the deputy leader for, I think, since March. I think we had the vote in February, March.
Mm. How's that deputy leadership been going?
It's a big role and it's mainly a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I bet.
But it's fantastic. So just people around New Zealand kind of notice that title a little bit more than some of the others sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's neat to be able to get out and engage with people around the country. And so, yeah, having the title helps, but then there's a lot of work attached to that in terms of the party itself.
Mm.
And so it's good. It's really positive.
Nice. So New Zealand First has just hit its 25-year mark. which is quite a milestone. I mean, it's the third longest running party in the country. You've been a part of the party since the start, have you?
Yeah, that's where I do. Back when it started, I was a teenager and kind of only mildly interested in politics. It was more my parents dragging me along, you know, as parents are wont to do. And but I was there when we revealed the name and launched at the official launch. So, and then have been a kind of an active member ever since. Yeah. And I'm based in Rotorua, so right back at the start, I kind of joined the local committee, electorate committee, and, you know, helped out where I could. And over the years, just the role's gotten bigger and bigger until I became an MP.
Yeah, nice. So would you say now, 25 years on, as deputy leader, what do you think is different about what the party is standing for, and what do you think is the same?
Well, actually, that's a great question. So just last night, we were talking about our 15 fundamental principles, the principles on which the party was formed, and just how important they are today as they were 15 years ago. Mm. And I'd like to say the changes are around the professionalism of the caucus, although that might be unfair because I'm sure the people from back in the day will think they were very probably way more professional than us. So, you know, it's Parliament itself and government itself is quite a different beast, and so there's, I think it is fair to say, and it'd be interesting to have a debate, the workload and the professionalism required is a lot higher. So that's Parliament and government, and, you know, New Zealand First has to evolve with that, or it gets left behind. Yeah.
Looking into the future for the party, I mean, there's not a great track record with coalition partners being re-elected. I mean, what's next for New Zealand First?
Yeah, so that I've often talked about that challenge because you're absolutely right. The history of politics is that the good stuff gets blamed, gets accredited to the bigger coalition partner, and everyone says what a good government, but actually they're thinking of the bigger partner, and the stuff that goes wrong, people seem to hold the minority partner to account and say, you know, why didn't you stop that, or why didn't you do this? So actually that's very much part of my job, is getting out there and telling people New Zealand First chose Labour as the coalition partner, and we absolutely did the right thing. And so the good and the bad, you know, the frustrations, and but all the good stuff that's happening as well is very much the coalition government, and that is New Zealand First. So we have to get out there and remind people that we're doing the good things as well, and that's happening because of what we've been able to do in coalition.
Would you say that you're the sort of youthful face of the party, this new youthful face that counteracts Winston Peters' age? I mean, in comparison to Peters?
Yeah, in contrast to Miss Peters, I do look like, but we do have only one younger, actually, MP in his 30s with the party, Derek Ball. So probably not the youthful face of the party, but being in your early 40s in politics is definitely...
You'd get branded as young.
Yeah, young, although the Prime Minister is about 5 years younger than me, I think.
Hmm. So would you say, as deputy, I mean, Winston Peters isn't going to be around forever, would you say as deputy you're a front runner for leadership in the future?
The process is kind of the same as how we kind of vote each term.
Right.
The team gets together and we actually pick the new leader as a team. So the deputy leader role isn't necessarily that kind of next step to leadership. It's got its own function. You know, it's a support role, it's a coordination role, and I don't know, you know, maybe one day, but certainly not anytime soon. Winston's still doing a great job and enjoying himself, so while that combination is there, I don't think we would want to change as a party.
So you could potentially see yourself running as leader one day?
Oh, one day, potentially. never, right?
Yeah. So tonight at midnight, Winston will be handing back the prime ministerial duties to Jacinda Ardern. In hindsight, how do you think he's managed his duties as acting PM?
Exactly how he intended to, with just to literally get on with the job and deal with the issues as they arise, but otherwise make sure that Cabinet and the senior ministers and all the other ministers who are MPs just simply get on with their jobs of government. And it's been quite surprising, given the media bash-up before he became the acting Prime Minister, just how complimentary the media has been. I daren't say his name, but even Mike Hoskins has been complimentary.
No, yeah, I just read that. Very, yeah, interesting.
Crazy, right?
there have been a couple of headline-worthy moments. Would you say Winston's been sort of standing his ground? I mean, and especially in terms, you're a Foreign Affairs Undersecretary. You'd be involved with the issue with Australia not backing down on deportation policy. He said that they should change their flag to a kangaroo. How do you think he's been handling all of this?
I think that was something, a jestful highlighting of the fact that actually Australia changed their flag after we had changed ours. And,
was that serious?
No.
Is there any sort of serious side to that, his angle?
Although it would be nice if they changed it, because it was only during that silly flag referendum that you really sat down and analysed the difference in colours between the stars and the actual star. So you were very sure of the difference in case someone, you know, goes, which one is which?
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you think the relationship between our countries is faring at the moment? I mean, Peter Dutton did take a swipe at our security efforts in the region, says Australia does a lot of the heavy lifting. Andrew Little did sort of snipe back. What do you think is happening here?
Well, he was quite specific about what he was referring to about heavy lifting, and actually we don't get a lot of boat people coming to New Zealand, not necessarily because of Australia's efforts, but because we're literally too far away. I have the title of what's called a delegation for the Pacific. So part of my job in foreign affairs is the Pacific, and I've seen our military efforts in terms of trying to stop drug running. I've seen how armed forces after natural disasters, our police are deployed in the Pacific, and we have active patrolling in the area. So actually, yes, Australia does do a lot, but, you know, given our size, we most definitely pull our weight in the Pacific. So it's an interesting debate, but I think fundamentally the relationship is a strong one. They are literally, you know, they are our cousins, as it were, and we are arguably two of the closest economies in the world, and we do an incredible amount together.
Terms of their deportation policies and sort of it's a human rights issue that goes against everything that our country stands for.
Well, holding that 17-year-old was definitely a breach of human rights. Unfortunately, what they're doing now is quite legal. They're entitled to do it. It's just we need to be able to work with them and try and work our way through it. But, I mean, this is the nature of... I mean, have you seen Australian politics at the moment?
It's quite a
difficult and very different world to our own. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it. There are aspects of it that are challenging. No doubt about it at all.
Moving on, you are also Regional Development Undersecretary. You and Shane Jones did visit the West Coast, was it the week before last?
That's right.
What is the sort of general feel there among the locals? I mean, there's a lot of anger, I think. Do you agree with Jones that mining does need to be a part of the regional economic development there?
It's actually core New Zealand First policy. So, you know, as an independent party, we definitely say that. But I think what we're trying to do now is, as part of a government, say, how, excuse me, how can we make sure that mining is part of a way forward there? Because there's some good resources that can be extracted safely and sustainably and environmentally, as it were, and you know, we just have to make sure that it can be done. It's just where and how. So those are the debates that politicians are having in the coalition. And you know,
Eugenie Sage, Conservation Minister, did say that there will not be any mining. Jacinda Ardern's on her side. So is it just going to be a matter of some negotiating?
No new mining on the Dock Estate.
Right.
So there's existing mining. There's the question of what is the Dock Estate, because there are lands there that could be easily argued that are actually not the Dock Estate. They're just currently managed by Dock. So these are the issues that we have to work through and make sure everyone's you know, kind of on the same boat as we move forward. Because if we do it right and safely and sustainably and environmentally, it is good for the economy.
Mm.
We've been speaking with Jenny Marcroft from the New Zealand First Party.
The Wire.
Primary school teachers and principals have voted to go on a full-day strike on 15th of August. Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters has called the strike disappointing, but the New Zealand Educational Institute says there is a crisis that needs to be addressed right now. To find out more about this, I spoke to Linda Stewart, President of the New Zealand Educational Institute.
I think what's happened is we've absolutely, the membership have said well and truly that they need to send a strong signal around how they're feeling about the negotiations that we're in at the moment. And so we are in negotiations. We started our paid union meetings a couple of weeks ago where we presented the Ministry of Education's offer, and it was overwhelmingly rejected by the membership. Whilst we were moving through the paid union meetings over the couple of weeks that they were on, the members actually called for stronger action. So moving from a three-day strike to a full-day strike was absolutely the members' decision in the end. We've just completed a secret ballot, and hence the overwhelming decision from the members was to move to a full-day strike. So it's really signalling the depth of feeling that there is from teachers and principals across this country around those issues that are facing us at the moment. There is a crisis in education that we cannot ignore, and it is not all of this government's making. We absolutely understand this. But actually, it is up to the government to look at it and to work through the ways that we solve the issues that are in front of us.
And as you were just saying, that the strike was previously planned to be for 3 hours and now it's gone to a full day strike. Do you think you'll be able to like get your point across and achieve what you want through a whole day strike?
Well, we would like to. We're currently in negotiations. Again, our primary teachers are in negotiations at the moment, and our principals were in negotiations last week. The Ministry and NZEI have agreed to bring a mediator into the process also. So we're absolutely wanting to move things forward in a positive way. We're in negotiations in good faith, and we want to come to an agreement. At the moment, we have a situation where we're not there. So obviously, you know, people want to avert these strike actions, but at the moment we're in a situation where this is the plan.
So what is the plan for schools then? Because I believe it's a Wednesday, the day of the strike.
Yes, it's the 15th of August, and Boards of Trustees will be making the decisions based on their staff, whether they've got strong union membership or just what it looks like for their particular school. They'll be contacting New Zealand School Trustees Association if they have any queries around that. We're also sending out information to our Boards of Trustees around the formal notification of strike action. So we're doing all those things. School trustees are there to support Boards of Trustees. Each board will make their decision based on the health and safety issues around their school on that day.
Do you feel like you had the public support behind the strike?
We absolutely do have public support. We've been monitoring that since March of this year, and just recently we released another piece of information around the public. And what I'm hearing anecdotally is around boards of trustees who are very, very supportive of their teachers within their own schools and also supportive of their principals. And this Friday we've actually got a day where we're encouraging our schools to actually talk a little bit more with the communities around the issues that are really facing them at a local level. So we've got all sorts of activities that are being planned for schools across this country.
The Ministry of Education offered a pay rise over 3 years. Why was that not sufficient?
So one of the things that we said right from the outset, and I just have to front foot this and say that this is not all about pay. Pay is one part of it. We've said that we would need a significant pay jolt to attract people into the profession. At the moment, we have 40% less people going in to train as teachers, and that's because our young people have a number of choices that they can make on leaving school and on leaving tertiary education. So, and teaching is not one of them at the moment, and that's a real shame, but that's the reality. So we know that we're not getting people into teaching. If we do get them into teaching, we can't keep them in teaching. And so we know that we need a significant pay jolt in order to be able to attract people into teaching and then keep them there. The other thing that is really important to our people is around the workload and the issues that they're facing when they are in the job. So one of the things that we've talked about is having the time to teach. Or in a principal's case, it's having the time to do the jobs that you need to do as a leader. We also have our U1 and 2 principals, who are our principals of our very smallest schools, who need a great deal more support than they've got at the moment. Sometimes they are the only adult on site in their schools, and that provides a real health and safety issue for them. We've also got in our classrooms those children who've got significantly challenging behaviours or additional learning needs, and we're wanting to ensure that our teachers get the support that they need for those children. And we've got solutions that we've put forward for the discussion over negotiations. So it's not just about pay, but the pay that was offered for the majority of our teachers was actually not significantly enough to be accepted by teachers.
Do you think going on strike, the payment for teachers will possibly get better? Do you think it will make this line of work more appealing?
So firstly, I'd like to say that teachers don't take the option of going on strike lightly. This is the first time it's happened in 24 years. So it's been a huge decision for our membership to make, but they've made it really clearly. Secondly, around education and being in teaching, I've been in teaching for over 30 years now. I have absolutely loved my role, firstly as a teacher, then as a senior leader, and then as a principal of a school. I don't think there's any other career that, you know, that I would have wanted to go into. But what I do acknowledge is the fact that this has become harder and harder and harder for our teachers. And so therefore, we want to ensure that it is an attractive career, that people do want to go into it, that they get the joy from it that I've got over the years, because actually my experience is that my colleagues and those young people that I meet that are going into teaching go into it because they really want to make a difference for children. And that's the passion and the commitment that we need to see in our teachers. So let's make it worth that. Let's actually show that we really value our teachers by taking what we're bringing forward as solutions really seriously.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. We do.
The Wire.
All right, we have a couple more announcements to play right now, but we will be back after this break to talk about period poverty. At lunchtime. Don't worry, it's not graphic, so stay tuned.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Molds. Thank you.
Cheer
up. What are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine. Women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep.
Next week, Whenua as a legal entity.
Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week, with your rotating roster of hosts.
The Wire.
Countdown has counted down the cost of more than a dozen women's sanitary items in order to reduce period poverty. Since the launch of this initiative via the Food Bank Project, Countdown, the Salvation Army and Manulife MP Louisa Wall have helped stock the charity's food banks with sanitary products. Since the launch of this campaign, more than $190,000 worth of tampons and pads have been donated. To find out more about this initiative, I spoke to Labour MP for Manulife, Louisa Wall.
Period poverty essentially is a state where an individual or families or communities do not have the resources to be able to continue to enjoy life through the provision of sanitary pads, tampons, menstrual cups. That means they can go on and through their normal daily commitments and business. So period poverty essentially means you don't have access to those products. It limits your ability to have a full life. For some of our young people, it means they don't get to go to school. And it also means that they miss out on opportunities. Actually does interfere in the long term with their education and their life opportunities. So in all countries around the world, we're now seeing this as an issue. And actually in 2014, the United Nations said that menstrual hygiene, period poverty, access to appropriate products was a global human rights issue and a global SDG 5 now. So it was actually interfering with policy for women and girls and instead with our dignity to live our lives fully.
So this campaign was launched with the Salvation Army, Countdown and yourself to highlight period poverty, and it's been 2 years in the making. How did you get behind this?
I got behind it essentially because I had voices from my community, young people saying that when they had their periods, for example, it limited their ability to go to school. I had a university student that said when she had her period, she had to choose between buying menstrual health products, eating, or catching a bus to study. I had principals saying to me that they were really aware that the kids were coming to school without hygiene products, and particularly for the girls. And he knew because they were using all the toilet paper toilets, and he was worried that they were going to be infected and that there would and could be long-term consequences. So really my involvement has been based on real experiences from individuals, communities, families, and then wanting to do something about it. And that do something about it really coincided with Countdown and the Salvation Army's launch of their, it's called the Food Bank Project, which essentially is an online donation. You can donate in stores, as we all know, but there's also an opportunity to donate online. And when we all met, it seemed serendipitous because what they had been trying to do was to get people to donate on a regular basis. And so having people donate on a monthly basis to coincide when young women and girls were getting their periods, just a really good opportunity for us all to work together to provide product for the Salvation Army to then distribute to the people that they work with, those families and communities who need their help.
So even though the prices have been reduced, there are some communities or people who will not be able to afford this. What about them?
That's exactly the point, which is why having donations on a regular basis has meant that the Salvation Army has a base of stock that they receive every month that they distribute through their seven stores. I think what it's highlighted, though, is that local communities have started to talk about the issues and started to look at what the solutions are for them. And so, for example, my colleague Willow Jean Prime has been working with her sister, Susan Mary, in Northland, and over the last year they've actually distributed 2,000 menstrual cups to young women in their community as an alternative to needing to use tampons and pads, which has meant that if it works for them, they actually have the tool, which is the menstrual cup, to be able to live with their period in a way that means they can continue to go to school and play sport and do everything else. So, you know, we've seen an emergence because of the need and because of the communities that have started to talk about the issue, and I do want to talk about stigma and embarrassment. And one thing we should never be as women is embarrassed by the fact that we have our periods. We talked yesterday about celebrating womanhood, and that includes celebrating menstruation. And Julie Chapman spoke on behalf of Kids Can, and I think the saddest thing she said yesterday was that she knew of young girls who, through period poverty, actually didn't want to be a girl because they didn't want to have their periods. And I think that's a sad state of affairs when it's actually affecting the mental health of our young people and the celebration of who they are.
Looking more into this, I found out that sanitary items could be used as a site of violence in domestic abuse cases where the partner would use this as a way to control females in the household. Why is there not enough awareness around this?
I think there isn't enough awareness because the people who are in the situation, so the victims, those who are being abused, and as we all know, family violence is incredibly prevalent in our society, we internalise it. We think it's all our fault. We're embarrassed. We think people won't believe us. They won't support us. And we cope and we go on with life in these circumstances because we don't see that there is an alternative. And in fact, that's what I've loved most about working with Countdown and the Salvation Army, is what we've all honoured actually are the voices of people who have shared their experiences, the people that we serve, that we work with, that we're trying to help. It's been through them and more of them coming forward that we've started to understand the size and scale of the issue, which is why Countdown's initiative to reduce the home brand range by 48% and to distribute now $2 packs of sanitary pads right around the country, I think is phenomenal.
So in 2016, the New York City Council introduced free tampons and pads to public schools, prisons and homeless shelters. Is there any possibility of New Zealand following a similar path?
I think that selecting certain groups who we believe should have access to these products and targeting those to those most in need actually has been behind the government support of Kids Can and the purchasing of products by Kids Can to distribute to those decile 1, 2 and 3 schools that they support throughout the country. And so that's over 650 schools now, high schools, intermediate, secondary schools. So that has been our response. Some people, myself and others, have tried to work with Pharmac to designate menstrual cups as medical device so that they could be, people could have access them based on a script that their medical practitioner would write for them. But I think what is starting to happen and what I've started to read and hear about are workplaces now just generally providing sanitary products in bathrooms. But one of the interesting things that happened from our discussion yesterday, we had a whole group of Wellington High School students, and with, I guess, an emphasis on the environment and maybe menstrual cups are a good tool, and especially for young women, hygiene issues, and are our bathrooms fit for purpose for young women and girls who will have to clean those menstrual cups? Is the water hot enough? Have they access to soap? You know, is there going to be stigma if they wash their blood in those bathroom sinks? Are they going to have specific cubicles with hand washing facilities? So, you know, there is a lot to happen in this space, I believe. But I also do see a trend that many more young women will start using menstrual cups as their product of choice.
And following on from that, as you're saying, women and young girls will start using menstrual cups as their choice. What about in, I guess, there are some cultures out there that are kind of against, like, using tampons. What about them?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right, which is why you need the range of products available. And in fact, when you're working with homeless people, which we do in Manurewa, the packs don't have tampons in them. They have sanitary pads in them because they need disposable items for exactly the reasons I've just highlighted about hygiene and making sure you're able to wash your hands, etc. So different communities, different cultural groups need different products. And actually, there is another product that Days for Girls produces. They're an international organisation. We have groups around New Zealand, women who sew and prepare reusable sanitary protection. And you can slip a pad in there and then continue to reuse this item. They've been sending these items over to places like Kenya and Uganda. And I think what's some of the women have realised in New Zealand is that actually we have pockets of communities in New Zealand who need these products too. So I think the ability for us to talk about this in a way that is powerful and empowering has also provided an opportunity for us to actually see and to understand what is available. And Heather Henner there, who was at the forum yesterday, she's part of Skylight, has offered to create as part of their virtual hub a section around period poverty and for us to start documenting all the different community responses so that we can start sharing some of this best practice, giving other communities options and opportunities for dealing with period poverty, which also includes how do you engage with communities who you don't see, who you know must have issues with period poverty, to make sure that they have access to the products they need as well.
It's fucked.
So are there...
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Sorry, we had to cut that down a little bit because we are coming up to the end of the show, but you can find this interview on the BCast section. Again, I'm really promoting those BCasts today. But yeah, you can find all of this interview and the rest of the things that we talked about today on 95BFM's website. All right, that brings us to the end of the show. Oh, there you go.
That was The Wire.
All right, I think it's my time to talk now. So, big thank you to all of those who spoke with us today on the show. That's Alan Blackman, Fletcher Tabateau, Linda Stewart, and Louisa Wall. Thank you to my producers, Darish, Pete, and Harry. And thank you to you guys in your cars, homes, or at work who enjoy listening to us during lunchtime, even when we talk about period at that time. Sorry about that again. It's been a really big pleasure for me to talk to you these past few weeks, and I will... be there next week, same time. That's all for us for today, though. And so, in the meantime, Bridges Up with the 1 to 4 on 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/BCasts.